Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Science with Dr. Carl. I'm Lucy Smith, and this week we're joined again by ABC Science reporter Olivia Willis. Of course, we took on your COVID-related questions, like how long does an asymptomatic person stay asymptomatic? Why do we keep focusing on the total amount of coronavirus cases rather than the active case number? And should we be worried about the fumes from hand sanitizer? We also took a left field question which lit up the text line. How long should you keep a hot chook from the supermarket? The guy who asked would eat his on day 6. We'll get into that and more. Let's do it. Dr. Carl and Olivia Willis join me right now. Dr. Carl, how you doing?
I'm surviving very well in the bunker. Getting used to staying at home and kind of thinking, wow, so the time I used to spend travelling, I could use that to learn a new language and pump iron and then also come up with the consolidated new theory of everything. What about you, Dr. Olivia?
Haven't come up with any new scientific theories, but I'm going okay. I'm getting a little bit of cabin fever at home. I'm in at the ABC today, which is really nice to leave the house, but otherwise working from home.
Yeah. And I do have to ask, Carl, how are your gains going? Are you getting swole or what?
Our what going? Our gains?
How's your muscle going?
Oh, pumping iron. Doing really well. I did a 1.5 hour pump yesterday morning because I had a surfing accident about 10 years ago where I smashed the ball of my right shoulder into 40 different little pieces held together by blood clot. And I didn't do the right rehab and it was complicated because the treatment was basically, and I quote, benign and masterful neglect, where I had to do the physio. And I sort of bounced around until I got some physios. And, man, I'm getting more symmetrical by the day. I've already got back, wait for it, the unilateral boob flex.
The unilateral what flex?
Boob.
Oh, okay.
Left, right. I can do them one at a time, mate.
We are going to be taking people's questions this morning, so should we just hop straight into it?
Let's do it.
All right. We're going to start in the Sunshine Coast with Amber. Amber, what's your question?
Hi, doctors. So I've been reading Dr. Carl's road trip book, which is extremely fascinating. And I was reading about the trypophobia, where he kind of hypothesized that trypophobia came from deadly diseases such as smallpox and leprosy. So I was wondering what your hypothesis is in regards to the evolution of people with the COVID-19. I predict that it'll be a fear of small spaces, but, you know.
Well, I was reading a paper this morning by the person who, Fauci, F-A-U-C-I, who is the head of allergy and infectious diseases in the USA since 1984 and is on the White House coronavirus campaign. And he wrote a paper called Emerging Patterns in Infectious Diseases about 10 years ago, looking at a whole bunch of infectious diseases and trying to find out what sort of common patterns there were. And this one really surprised me. As a result of the plague coming into Europe in the 1300s, and the plague came through time after time and killed about 50 million people, as a result, 1% of the population do not have the CCR5 receptor, which means to the disease called AIDS. They can get infected by the virus HIV, 1% of Europeans, but it just floats in their bloodstream. It has no effects on them. Sometimes they're carriers, sometimes they're not. So the viruses will influence us. So we have lived with microbes. We think we're the peak of civilization because we've invented all this stuff, but we've been living with microbes, which are bacteria, viruses, parasites, prions, for hundreds of thousands of years, and they're vectors, which is how they get from one animal to another, and they're hosts and they're reservoirs, and we're all living together. So there will be changes. So the people who survive will be slightly more resistant to various diseases, and we won't know with regard to the plague, it took 7 centuries before it turned out to be useful for 1% of people in Europe who couldn't get AIDS. How's that for a first approximation, Dr. Amber?
Fascinating. Extremely fascinating. Thank you.
Let's go to South Australia now with Andrew. Andrew, you want to know something specific about COVID-19?
I was just wondering why it's called COVID-19. Is there like a COVID-1 to COVID-18 as well?
Great question, Andrew. I'm not sure there's 1 through to 18. The reason it's called COVID-19 is basically it's coronavirus disease and it first emerged in 2019, so that's why we put it together like that. There are other coronaviruses that circulate in the community that we don't refer to in the same way, but the 19 in particular, that's associated with 2019 rather than it being kind of a, you know, cumulative tally of coronaviruses.
I could see why that would potentially confuse people because the brunt of this has been in 2020.
Exactly.
But it first reared its head in 2019.
Yeah, in around late November, December.
Yeah, good question, Andrew. Craig in the Blue Mountains, what would you like to know this morning?
Morning, doctors.
Good morning.
My question is just around aerosolisation and how that plays a part in this, and what are some sort of common things around the house potentially that we use that aerosolise and how it might be putting us more at risk.
Yeah, so what we know about aerosolisation, there's been a little bit of research looking at whether COVID-19, you know, is an airborne virus or whether it can spread by aerosols. They're those tiny little particles of about 5 microns or less in diameter. And because they're tiny and light, it means they kind of stay suspended in the air as opposed to falling to the ground, like those respiratory droplets, which we know are the key way that it spreads. There was some research that was done that found that COVID-19 could last in the air as aerosols for about 3 hours, but it was done in artificial conditions and kind of created using this high-powered machine that doesn't reflect, you know, a kind of normal cough or splutter or the way that humans would spread it. So we don't think that it's spreading via aerosols in the community. We don't think that's a key way of transmission, though it's possible. There is an exception to that where we think there's a risk, and that's in medical settings. So we know that there's particular medical procedures where the virus can become aerosolized. So one of those is intubation, for example, when you're inserting a tube through a person's mouth and into their airway to help them breathe. And I think also when doctors are kind of disconnecting people from ventilator machines, that can also potentially create some aerosols. And that's why doctors at the moment are being recommended to wear those N2 respirator masks, because that provides that extra protection. Mm. In terms of at home and around in the community, I wouldn't be... Let's just say we're not super concerned that that's a way that it's spreading. It's possible, but most of the advice that we've got around keeping your distance and staying at home, that applies to that too, to reduce your risk of if it is spreading in the air, but it doesn't seem to be a key way.
Yeah. Can I ask you, Olivia, I've been reading a lot of what you've been saying about the aerosols, and thanks for that 5 micron thing I hadn't realised. What about the naked virus by itself? Can, you know, it's like 50 or something nanometers or billions of a meter across. Do we have any information, or have they been researching how the naked virus by itself, you know, independent of droplets, can float in the air?
It's a really good question. I'm not 100% sure. I mean, it seems certainly like it's possible, but I think, yeah, I wouldn't know. I wouldn't know more on the kind of naked virus question. I think, as I said, that, you know, the WHO's been pretty clear that they think it's a low risk in terms of spreading that way, and that's why so much of the messaging has been around the close contact stuff. There is kind of some evidence on some of the cruise ships that maybe it was lasting in the air for a little bit longer or surviving on surfaces for a bit longer, but I think that's probably to do with kind of the lack of ventilation. But in terms of that question, Dr. Carl, I'm not 100% sure. I'm sure lots of people are looking into it.
Justin from Brisbane, what's going on?
Good morning, doctors. How are we all?
Good.
Very good, Dr. Justin.
Jolly good. Now, I'm sorry if I make anyone squeamish, because every time I talk to my missus about it or my friends, they think I'm weird. The old hot chooks from the supermarket, I love them. I'm sure everyone else does too, but up to 5 or 6 days later, I grabbed the old carcass out of the fridge and bung it in the microwave for 7 or 8 minutes, and away I go again. Now, my nurse friend, she said this is extremely dangerous and I shouldn't do it, but I think it's delicious. So I just wanted to get your advice on what you think.
Justin, can I just ask, how much is left on the carcass after 5 days? Because I don't know, I get straight into the bag and I go hell for leather on that rotisserie chook.
Yeah, see, my missus just eats the breast off. She doesn't eat any other part of the chicken, which I think is disgusting. And I eat the wings and drumsticks, and then I kind of just leave whatever else is left on there, you know, the tasty bits
okay.
for 5 days later.
So we're leaving it up to 5 to 6 days later, chucking it in the microwave. And Justin, you're wanting to know, is this safe or...?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay. What's the verdict, Dr. Carl, Olivia?
Well, I'm sort of going back to the words of the person I get a lot of my ethical and moral values from, Clint Eastwood, Dirty Harry. Are you feeling lucky, comma, punk, question mark? So this is how it goes. Let me give you the best possible case. So you get the chicken, you take it home, it's pretty clean, you put it in the fridge, it's pretty clean, it's nice and cold, the bacteria don't grow at all. You heat it up, fine. Let's just go a little bit harder. You take it home, the bacteria grow on it, but the bacteria are not doing anything to the chicken, they'll only do something to you. So you cook it, but not hot enough. You cook it hot enough. You do 70 degrees C, you'll kill most bacteria, and the bacteria die. You then are eating chicken with dead bacteria, but in most cases you'll get by okay. Okay, now for the nasty one. It gets infected with bacteria, but these bacteria make a toxin. This toxin is really tough. It'll take 120 degrees C. So the one that gave us Botox... botulinum, that bacterium, when you hit it with some heat, it immediately goes into a spore and it can take 120 degrees C. Now, some bacteria make toxins that can survive 120 degrees C. So it lives in the fridge, it makes a toxin. You then heat it up in the microwave to 100 degrees centigrade and you definitely kill all the bacteria. But the toxin still survives. How lucky are you feeling, punk?
Well, I haven't got sick off it yet, so I don't know.
Well, the way we got the name Botulus is that a bunch of people in Germany in the 1600s, 13 of them sat down to have a delicious dinner of sausage, and if you've been to Germany, you know how much they love their sausage, and 7 of them died, and the Latin word for sausage is botulus, so that's how we got the name Botulus, botulinum and Botox.
Someone on the text line saying, I just ate roast chook at Smoko that I bought last Sunday, so I'm really hoping Carl says 10 days. Excuse me. Oh, my gosh. Some of you are really playing with fire. We've got a text here from Christina, and this is a topic that we've touched on before with you, Olivia, about vaccines. So she said, as far as I understood, vaccines often take quite a long time to develop due to the numerous amounts of tests and trials to confirm safety before releasing it to the public for access. With outbreaks like COVID-19, where finding a vaccine is an urgent matter, how do scientists shorten the development stage of the drug while still assessing and confirming its safety for the public?
Yeah, look, Christina's right. It normally takes kind of around 2 to 5 years to develop a vaccine. But at the moment, we've got kind of various different rapid vaccine development technologies, which mean that it could be, we're trying to condense it down to around the 12 to 18 month period, which is mm-hmm. generally what places like the WHO are saying in terms of the estimation at the moment for how long it's going to take. I guess... You know, the scientists at the moment, they can rely on a little bit of the past science that we've used around developing vaccines for similar viruses, but creating a new vaccine really isn't just as simple as subbing out, you know, an old virus and putting in a new one, because each virus kind of prompts a different immune response in our body. There's you know, concentrated effort to focus on this vaccine given the risk that coronavirus currently poses at a global scale. So that's part of the reason why it is being scaled up time-wise. And we've also got places like the WHO trying to coordinate global efforts. So scientists across countries and different institutions are sharing their research. But it will need to go through all the safety checks that a normal vaccine does. So those preclinical trials of testing on animals, does the vaccine, you know, produce antibodies? Does it protect against the illness? Does it create the right type of immune response? What dose, etc.? So it will still go through phase 1, 2, 3 trials, etc. And then, you know, we'll make sure there's surveillance once it's in the community to make sure that it's safe. But I guess it's probably the concentrated effort. The short answer is a lot of effort, and we've got a little bit of previous science that can help us with this one.
Let's go to Steve in the Gong now. Steve, you've got a coronavirus question. What's up?
Yeah, I was wondering if, well, first, hi, doctors.
Hi.
Good morning.
Hi.
But if people can be asymptomatic for up to 14 days, how many days is it until you can actually detect the virus in a person who's been infected? And then also, how many days from infection is it until they can infect others?
Yeah, look, this is a tricky one. I think that in terms of when an asymptomatic... So we know that the incubation period for coronavirus, which is basically a time between catching the virus and then beginning to have symptoms for people that are symptomatic, that is anywhere between 1 and 14 days roughly, but most commonly about 5 days. So if you get it on, if you contract it on Monday, by Friday you should be showing symptoms. And that's also when we tend to be most contagious. So you can, if you're symptomatic, you can kind of spread the virus about 24 to 48 hours before you show symptoms, and then you're most contagious or infectious at that time as well, in the early days of that. And it slowly starts to dissipate over the time. So my estimated guess would be that the same kind of thing would be happening for asymptomatic carriers, that they would be most infectious that they would be most infectious early on when they get the virus, and then then it would kind of dissipate over time. They would become less infectious. One of the real challenges, obviously, testing for asymptomatic people. We're not doing it at the moment here just because of our limits in testing. We have expanded it a little bit, so now you can get a test, I think, in most states. You don't have to have necessarily been in contact with a COVID-19 carrier, but, you know, you might have kind of common cold and flu symptoms. There are issues around testing that, you know, you can start to pick up what's known as kind of the viral bits kind of the RNA that means that the virus is not active in your body. You're not likely to be contagious, but there's little reservoirs of virus in you that may indicate a positive test, but you wouldn't be infectious. I might defer to Dr. Carl here. Is there anything to add around when we... Well, I guess it kind of comes back to the question of false positives and negatives, doesn't it, Dr. Carl?
Well, Dr. Olivia, you've covered everything, and all I can do is fill in the don't knows or mention them, which is that we don't know if there are asymptomatic carriers. So in the years between 1967 and 1977, the World Health Organization was able to wipe out smallpox for two reasons. Number one, the only carrier was humans. Unlike the flu, it didn't jump to birds and pigs. Number one, the only carrier was humans. And number two, there were no such things as asymptomatic carriers. We're in the early stages. We don't know if there are asymptomatic carriers. What Olivia said.
Yeah, I think we generally think probably that it's likely there are. The CDC in the US has estimated they think up to about 25% of people might be asymptomatic. The other issue with this virus is you can have a very, very mild case of it. So you're not technically asymptomatic, but the symptoms are so minor that you wouldn't realise you had it.
We've got a follow-up text here from someone saying, I hooked up with someone from a dating site recently who has contracted COVID and recovered. He's been cleared for almost 2 weeks. Will there be a chance of me getting infected? So could that person potentially be a carrier?
Look, it's certainly possible if they've been in close contact with someone who has COVID-19. As we said, you generally are going to, if you've been infected, you're likely to show, if you're symptomatic, show symptoms within kind of 2 weeks. But it's possible that you could be asymptomatic as well. So I think there's certainly the advice is, I think if you've been in contact, if you know you've been in contact with someone who's got a confirmed case, then it's best to try and self-isolate as well as much as possible, because you could potentially be a risk to the community. So trying to stay at home, and if you can, getting friends or neighbours or family or whatever to deliver food and that kind of stuff. But you might want to call your doctor too, just to check.
And the words of Frank Zappa, number one, your main sexual organ is your brain. The other bits just sort of help it happen, so you don't actually have to have physical contact. And number two, I've been told by my friends in the hospital system that with regard to some people who are pretty, unfortunately, picking up a bunch of diseases, STIs, that they've actually now expounding the virtues of masturbation, and I'm waiting for the ad campaign and the community service announcements on that one.
Stay home. It's going to have a whole new meaning. Joel from Forstar, what's your question this morning?
Yeah, I was just wondering... Hi, doctors, by the way. I was just wondering why we focus in on the total amount of cases and not just, like, the active. Showing, like, 6,500 in Australia... over 3,500 are recovered, so we've only got less than 3,000 active cases at the moment.
So the total amount of coronavirus cases as opposed to the active number of cases. Dr. Carl, Olivia, what do you reckon?
Well, I think that the reason we're looking at total amount rather than just active is because it gives us a picture of the spread and how we're controlling it. So we get a better sense of how many people in the community have it at one time, have recovered, how our, you know, whether our social distancing methods are working and so on, which at the moment it seems like they are. One of the challenges with monitoring case numbers, and it's something we talked about just before, is this idea of asymptomatic carriers. So it's very likely that we've got, or it's certainly possible that we've got a lot more people in the community who might be carrying it and they're not included in our case numbers just because we're not testing. So, you know, if you're testing people with symptoms, of course you're likely to find cases, but until we do very widespread testing as they're doing in some other countries, we're not going to have a complete picture of the caseload.
Yeah, also let's go back to 430 to 426 BC. That was the golden age of Greece, and the writer Thucydides chronicled, he wrote about the plague of Athens, which ended this golden age. Now, as a writer, he was amazing. The medical people study it in their infectious disease studies. He did more than simply describe the disease, its signs and symptoms, various clinical courses, you know, better or worse, complications, infection rates and death rates. He also looked at it from an epidemiological point of view. Epidemiological is a fancy word meaning medical statistics, and societal, how society happens. And he wrote about how this plague seemed to have multiple independent importations into Athens, how most people were susceptible to it, but not everybody was, and how it was linked to overcrowding and war and breaking down. And he stayed alive even though one third of the population of the city of Athens died in a plague. So to answer your question, only by getting all of the numbers, who recovers and who recovers quickly and slowly, do we then begin to get a better understanding of how we can treat it as we head down this disease, which is going to be with us until, at least in the florid stage, well, past winter and well and truly into summer.
On Triple J. That was The Avalanches with Running Red Lights. And Dr. Carl, you can still hear the tunes from the bunker, and you just pointed out this line.
I'm a thundercloud, ready to burst like Schrodinger.
Who is Schrodinger?
Schrodinger was one of the top quantum physicists of all time, probably smarter than Einstein, and Einstein couldn't do it, he solved the problem of why, when you stir a cup of tea with tea leaves in it, the tea leaves end up in the middle. Let's forget about that. And so he came up with Schrodinger's cat. Now imagine you've got a box, and inside the box is a cat that's alive, and there's a little clock, and you don't know when the clock is going to set the alarm off, and the clock is joined to a vial of cyanide. And at some stage, and you don't know when, it's going to tick, and then the cyanide is going to burst open. And the question is the cat alive or dead? And you haven't opened the box. And the answer is, so long as you don't open the box, the cat is both alive and dead at the same time. It's not one or the other. It's not alive and it's not dead. It's alive and dead. And only when you look at the cat does the, here comes a technical term, does the wave equation collapse? End of technical talk, and then the cat collapses into being alive or dead. And so the rain cloud is both raining and not raining at the same time. Oh, man, your music rocks.
Ah, oh, Dr. Carl, we're just going to have to get you to dissect all the tunes that we're hearing on Triple J. Love it when you get involved. Let's go back to science now for a minute, though. Chris from the Gold Coast, what's your question?
Hey, doctors. Hey, I know when you wash your hands, we're told to 20 seconds, you know, thoroughly fingertips, back, front, thought, side, sums all the rest, and that'll help kill virus and germs, and that's good hygiene. What about when you shower? Are you meant to let it sit for 20 seconds on you, the soap, and then rinse it off? Or, like, how's that supposed to work? Mm. And will it kill the germs, you know, the same as washing your hands?
Yeah, so the reason, I think probably the reason where we talk about that 20-second number, I guess it's not really a hard and fast rule, but the idea is that 20 seconds is going to give you enough time to really make sure you're covering all surfaces of your hands with the soap. That's the kind of key to doing it for a long period, to make sure we're properly lathering up. The soap is so important because it basically, this virus, as I've said before, it kind of has this fatty outer layer of lipid molecules, and what that means is when it comes into contact with soap, it it kind of breaks, so it gets rid of the virus straight away. In terms of lathering up in the shower, I mean, you'd probably likely be fine with what you're doing. So the key really is just making sure you're getting it everywhere. You're really getting all over your body, in particular in your hands. The hands is most important because that's obviously going to be probably the place where we're touching most surfaces and picking up the virus. But the 22nd time is more just to make sure you've thoroughly actually covered all surfaces rather than the amount of time that it comes underwater. So the water is not as important as the, well, you need to certainly wash with water, but the most important thing is that it comes into contact with soap.
Yeah, and in general, the only part of your body you touch to your face are your hands, unless you're state grade gymnast like my nieces in Newcastle, in which case you can touch your belly button to your mouth or your foot or any, but most of us only put our hands onto our face. So that's what you got to wash. If it turns out you do a lot of stuff with your feet and you're very agile, and in fact, Houdini, the famous escape artist, trained himself to be able to put his feet on the back of his head and could undo knots with his toes. So Houdini, if he was around now, he would have to wash both his hands and his feet really thoroughly.
We do have a text here actually from a teacher, and they've said, I'm a teacher and the Prime Minister wants us to go back to the classroom. Even though kids don't usually get COVID-19, how can we be really safe in an enclosed classroom with 20 plus kids coughing and sneezing and picking their noses and being so close?
Yeah, look, this is one of the really tricky decisions when it comes to our measures around closing things down and social distancing and so on. And there's been lots of debate about schools. We know, as there was mentioned, that kids generally, usually with other respiratory viruses, children tend to get more unwell, and they're often responsible for transmitting or kind of key carriers of transmitting illness. We know with COVID-19, children generally have a much lower risk of getting ill and certainly of dying. And they kind of, their symptoms, if they have them, are certainly on the less severe end of the spectrum. It's not clear at the moment how much they are carriers of the disease and whether they're a key way it's spreading in the community. There's been some modelling done to show that that might not be the case, which is, I think, part of the reason why schools were not closed down for a little while in Australia. In terms of reducing risk in classrooms, a key thing is all the things we're already talking about. So where possible, trying to keep distance between students and teachers and students and practicing good hygiene. Obviously, that's really challenging, as you say, with kids. Dr. Carl, you might have something to add there.
Yes. So I'm doing question and answer sessions with schools around Australia, usually over the internet, and I've been doing it two every Wednesday afternoon for the last couple of years, and I want to keep on doing it so we can still do it in a safe way with any school teachers or students there. Just go to my homepage and it'll tell you what to do there, and then email us. And we do it via a bunch of things, either Skype or Zoom or Teams or whatever. And this is a way that the new technology can still let us do some schooling in these tricky times. One weird thing I came across, Olivia, and I don't understand this one. Maybe you can help me. When the flu comes around, the schools are hotbeds of flu infections. But when COVID came around, it's not. Mm-hmm. Are we any closer to solving this?
Look, I'm not too sure. I think there's still a lot of questions around whether we do know, as I said, that children certainly seem to be getting the virus a lot less, and they certainly get it, cases are, less severe. So it's much more of a risk in older people and people with pre-existing conditions. I think there's questions around whether, like you say, with other viruses, whether they're able to spread it. And there are also still questions around the possibility of asymptomatic transmission and pre-symptomatic transmission and so on. So that makes it a little bit of a difficult picture, and it makes it difficult for, decision makers to work out to open up schools or close schools and so on. I think if you are going back to school, the best thing you can do is obviously, what's in your control around keeping distance, respiratory hygiene, etc. But obviously that's a challenge.
We're going to go now to Kath on the Central Coast, and we had a question about asymptomatic folk. And Kath, you're wondering about something along that line.
Yeah, I'm not from the Central Coast. I'm actually from the Central West, Bathurst way. But I'm wondering, hello doctors, I'm wondering how long asymptomatic lasts for. That's the one thing I sort of was very keen to understand.
Yeah, look, it's a great question, and I think that the answer is we really don't know. It's not quite clear at the moment how many people are carrying it asymptomatically and how long they're carrying it for and also how much they're contributing to the spread of it. Generally, people who are, if they're symptomatic and they're unwell, we know that they're told to isolate, I think, for around 3 to 5 days after their symptoms clear up. So it's, you know, it's possible that you're carrying it for, you know, a little bit longer after you've had symptoms, as well as we know the virus can shed before people show symptoms. But on the question of how long, I'm not 100% sure.
We've got a text here from Cassie after hearing yesterday's hack story, which you can always listen back to on the Hack podcast. She said, would love to know what Dr. Carl thinks of the US scaling back and cutting funding for the World Health Organization. Dr. Carl.
Well, military and medical people always have to make decisions with not enough information, and sometimes they get it wrong. And so the World Health Organization early on did say that there was no airborne transmission based on the early and incorrect data that they had. I'm a big fan of the World Health Organization because it got rid of smallpox. Smallpox killed 300 million people in the 20th century before it got wiped out in 1977. It'd be still around today if it wasn't for the World Health Organization. And they're doing great things with polio. They're certainly not a perfect organization, but nothing made by humans is perfect. So there's various things that they've done that I don't necessarily agree with, but overall, I think they're a good thing to have. And if the Americans don't fund it, then other people, I think, should. I'm kind of in favour, in fact, I'm definitely in favour of having the World Health Organization still running, and I think we should fund it.
We're going to go to Rod in Brisbane now. Dr. Carl, a couple of times you've mentioned the Spanish flu in comparison to COVID. Rod, what's your question?
I was looking at the Spanish flu and I read that it was like basically disappeared after a few years and doesn't exist anymore. Now, why is that and could that happen with COVID-19?
I think it was because it infected everybody who was susceptible to it, and it was a particular version of H's and N's. So think about measles. It doesn't change. It's always the same. Once you get infected, you're immune forever. But each flu virus is different. They've got different hooky things, proteins, whatever, on the outside. They are called H and N. H stands for hemagglutinin, and N for neuraminidase. And there's a dozen different types, H1N1, H2N2, H3N3, whatever you want. And some of them help it get in and out of cells. Some of them help the cell make more copies of itself. And they change all the time. So the flu virus, as it went around the world, was that particular version. And then it went away, except for a few virus particles, on the bodies of dead people in the permafrost in the Arctic region, from which it was recovered a few years ago. But if it were to come around again, it could still cause problems because we have never been infected with that particular version. But in the world, by the time you got to 2 or 3 years down the line, everybody had been kissed by it and either suffered or recovered and were immune to that particular one. And by the way, get your vaccine shots now, even though they're not perfect because they're a few months out of date, but it's still better than not getting vaccinated at all.
Almost at the end of Science with Dr. Carl, but let's squeeze in a few more questions before we do. Olivia Willis is on board as well. Ryan from Batemans Bay, what's your question?
Oh, how are you going, doctors?
Dr. Ryan, welcome.
How are we?
Good.
Just a question. I'm a Sparky and we've been working in all the burnout houses and whatnot. And it seems everywhere you go that's been burnt, there's just a massive amount of mosquitoes.
And so it's happening inside the houses or outside?
Just outside. Everywhere it's been burnt, like all through Mogo and Malua Bay and that.
Okay, number one, I don't know. Cameron Webb would know. He's the entomologist I normally go to. I'm reckoning that due to the fires, there's been a change in the environment which made it suitable for mosquitoes to breed and have babies. And part of that involves pools of water and a protected environment and a low wind. That's all I got. Cameron Webb, if you're listening, ring in or text in with the answer. Dr. Cameron Webb.
We are talking science and we've got a text here from Dan in the Shire saying, can you please ask the doctors if we need to be concerned about the fumes from hand sanitizer and methylated spirits?
Look, I think this is all kind of comes down to you do a bit of pros and cons balance. At the moment, we're obviously the risk of coronavirus is serious, and that's why we're saying to people, please wash your hands, and if you don't have that, certainly use hand sanitizer, and then cleaning using things like methylated spirits. I think you want to be careful, of course, when you're using things like methylated spirits at home. Hand sanitizer, I think the risk is pretty low, Dr. Carl.
Yeah, look, one thing I learned in surgery was the following. There are some people, you couldn't kill them with a lump of 4B2, and some people would drop dead from the shock of having a haircut. So there will be somebody out there who will be uniquely sensitive to what's in the sanitizers, but you can be pretty sure that they've been developed by an ethical company over a period of time and tested by the government, overwhelmingly you'll be safe. You might get a bit nauseous from it, but it's not going to give you a disease worse than getting COVID-19.
I used to have to use hand sanitizer regularly when I was working in hospitality, and if I'd had a big night the night before and I was a little bit hungover, sometimes I found that if I used the hand sanitizer and that whiff of alcohol, I just keep it in loose. All right, so Olivia, Dr. Carl, you guys have been joining us together for the last 3 weeks. At this stage, as far as the coronavirus, what's something that you'd like the audience to potentially take away or think about or look into?
I think at the moment a lot of people, you know, we're seeing the curve flatten in Australia, which is wonderful, and obviously we want to keep going in that direction. I think it's leading lots of people to think, oh, can we go back to life as normal and lift restrictions? I think the thing here is we're not near that point. So, yes, the government is working on our kind of steps out of this as we continue to see case numbers go down. But in terms of really getting a good hold on this and a good control, it's likely that we're going to have social distancing measures in place for some time, some form of them. Some things will start to lift, but I think, you know, it's really difficult. Our lives have really changed, but we need to be as patient as we can, because I think in the long term that's going to pay off.
Dr. Carl?
I remember when I was a single bloke living by myself, I used to get depressed every solstice, June 23, about 2 months from now, because that was the middle of winter. And I'd read about seasonal affective disorder, where you get depressed because there's not enough light around. So what I would do would be to change all the 50-watt light bulbs to 100-watt light bulbs. So here's my message. Winter's coming, and then we'll come out the other side. So it's a long-term thing. Get yourself sort of set up for how you're going to make it through the winter and then through into the summer after that.
Dr. Carl and Olivia, can we just do one final question here?
Yo.
Sure.
Dan in Townsville, with all the COVID conspiracy theories going around, is there a collective noun for a group of idiots? If not, could you coin the phrase?
An ignorance of idiots or a conspiracy of idiots?
Thanks for listening to another episode of Science with Dr. Carl with ABC Science reporter Olivia Willis. If you like what we do, feel free to like, rate, and subscribe. And I'll catch you next week. See ya.